Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The concept here is actually quite a simple one. Turns out executing it is harder than we'd like, but the concept is a simple one. You know, you pay your tax dollars, you pay your fees. If those are sitting in local community banks, that's fine by us. We want to work with community banks and make that reality a stronger one. But it turns out a lot of those dollars go to money center banks, including non-U.S. headquartered banks. And the dollars those banks then lend on, in most cases, don't come back to New Jersey. They build infrastructure projects on the campaign trail. I remember when I talked about a great infrastructure loan that was to Sweden and one to Japan. So they're making the right kind of loans, but they're not making them in New Jersey. And the concept is a bank owned by us to keep those dollars in New Jersey to benefit our economy. And for every dollar you put in to infrastructure, student loans, small business, affordable housing, you get multiple dollars back. And that's sort of the concept. Let's cut the leakage out.
That's the governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, announcing the creation of a new 14-person public bank implementation board, a step forward for institution of public banking across the country that moves New Jersey into a leading position among states. Hello and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. Today, we're celebrating this significant development, Executive Order 91, which puts New Jersey on a timeline for assessing the why, that is, the needs, and determining the how, the mechanics, that will guide future state action and presumably legislation for creating a new state bank in the Garden State. This is a big deal for public banking advocates, in that New Jersey is the country's most densely populated state and is an influential financial player with close ties, literally and figuratively, to Wall Street right across the river. In fact, Governor Murphy himself is a Goldman Sachs alumnus, which has given some people pause about whether he'd actually follow through with his campaign promise on creating a state bank a couple of years ago. But as he mentioned, there are numerous common sense reasons why he's pushing his administration forward on this, and we'll outline some of the reasons listed in his executive order, as well as the parameters and the implementation board that will help shed light on how New Jersey is going to be approaching this work. As you may recall, California made a similar significant breakthrough back in September when their governor, Gavin Newsom, signed into law a measure that would facilitate creation of municipal banks in the state, and laid out the framework for how that would take place, giving the process a window of 7 years in a trial fashion so that up to 10 cities can apply for bank charters. After that time, there will be a review period for how the banks are functioning. The cities are already lining up out in California to be among the first to do so, and with the new law only allowing establishment of 10 banks during that time, a lot of legislative activity is underway in cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Oakland, and others. So here we are, about 10 years after Ellen's book Web of Debt hit the bestseller list, exposing how the banking cartel and the business structure of private commercial banks and private capital have restricted access to affordable credit and built a $4.5 trillion market for municipal and state finance, and how the lack of democratic control on the creation of money determines whether economic systems will continue to virtually exclusively serve private interests. Ellen's subsequent books, The Public Bank Solution and her latest book, Banking on the People, continue that discussion and describe the interplay between private capital lenders and public needs, and the prospects of having a banking service that's owned as a public utility could dramatically expand our prospects for solving problems. We'll talk with Ellen in a few moments about how such a resource could be powerfully effective in creating a green transition to help get us past the threatening system collapses of infrastructure and civil order that appear on the horizon, and how international bodies are calling for the creation of public banks to accomplish those tasks. But today we're also going to be stepping back a bit into a more general discussion about money itself. What is it really? And how do the systems that embody and deploy it actually participate in the structures of general society? Our guest, once again, is Dr. Sean Vanatta, a professor at the Gallatin School at New York University, and who recently spoke with us about his study for the Abel Foundation about creating a Baltimore public bank. Dr. Vanatta is the author of Plastic Capitalism, Credit Cards, and the Making of Modern Consumer Finance. Also, a bit later, we'll have a brief reprise interlude with Swami Beyondananda that has a special relevance given the news out of New Jersey. But now let's connect with Ellen Brown and spend some time exploring the news of recent weeks in our world of public money.
Well, Ellen, this has been quite a week. We have, the last week, week and a half, we have seen some pretty exciting developments in the public banking frontier. We were fortunate to be together up in New York City with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert for their very lively show on economics and money, the Max Kaiser Report, which should be out pretty soon.
Yes, it was actually for two sessions. I think one is...
They're talking about the front-running issues for the 2020 election. But you were out on the East Coast to not just do that program, but also to make a presentation around the green transition and how public banking fits into that picture. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, I was invited to the BioNutrient Conference, and you might wonder what that has to do with public banking. They wanted two workshops. I did the first one on basically a deep dive into money and banking because I wanted to explain all those things that most people don't understand. I mean, the first thing you have to understand is how the whole banking system works. Then it's possible to show that we can fund all these things that people say are impossible to fund. So then in the second workshop called Funding the Green Transition with Public Banks, actually green transition was their term, avoiding Green New Deal, which is controversial, of course. So I wasn't going into the Green New Deal per se or politics, but I just went on the funding. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had included public banking in her Green New Deal, first in her December 2018 proposal, in which she said that it could be funded through the Federal Reserve or a national public bank or a network of public banks. And then in her February bill that was actually filed, it also included public banking as a source of funding, and it mentioned using public banking to leverage our money, which means band our credit power, because if you're a bank, you can lend 10 times as much on the same capital as if you're a revolving fund. So anyway, so in the course of researching that, I came across some pretty interesting stuff. Paul Hawken, who wrote a book called Project Drawdown, which was a bestseller, and he showed 100 possible solutions to the climate crisis. And even they were surprised at the results, that it wasn't what everybody thinks, that the most cost-effective solutions were not transportation, you know, switching over all our cars from fossil fuels over to electricity. It wasn't redoing all the buildings and redesigning the cities to make them more compact and efficient. It wasn't even electricity generation. The category that was the most cost effective was called food. How we grow our food, how we market our food, and how we use our food. So all those things. And of the top 30 out of 100, 12 of them were in the category of what you might call regenerative agriculture. So it seems that if you focus on growing trees, changing the way we do agriculture so that you don't break up the, like right now, I guess the typical way of farming is with this deep plowing that breaks up the microorganisms. But those microorganisms in the soil are important for carbon sequestration. They pull the carbon out of the air, and of course, all the plants pull carbon out of the air. They breathe in carbon dioxide, as we all know, and they turn the carbon into cellulose, and what they don't use goes into the earth in a biodegradable form, and then that makes the cellulose of plants, and it goes into our bones. You know, it's all the solid parts of life. We need it for life, and we need it in the earth. We don't want it in the air. So anyway, with those methods, I had read a study that two-thirds of the whole carbon problem could be solved just by planting trees, but it would take 50 to 100 years. And then another study showed that grasslands were even faster if you just plant grasses. And then another study showed that hemp was even faster. I mean, there are a number of agricultural solutions that would fix the problem without having to tighten our belts and give up all these things. I mean, normally you think of the Green New Deal as meaning we have to go into austerity, give up our cars, give up our planes, and different things. But in fact, we can have a more abundant life. We can have food that actually tastes good, for starters, and that improves our health, so that we cut down on our medical bills. We can have clean air, clean water, clean oceans, clean, healthy, regenerated soil. And then for financing, right now we're subsidizing the wrong kind of agriculture. So the agriculture that we do, predominantly the big ag, factory farming, and monocrops, are responsible for as much as 50% of the climate problem, according to one study. The official figure is 11%, but when you count in all the externalities, it's as much as 50%. And we are subsidizing that form of agriculture. We're giving them $20 billion a year in subsidies. So you could just switch those subsidies over to regenerative farming practices. But of course, in my presentation, I went into ways of funding the other things that were in, you know, the big ticket items in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's bill, which would be like a universal basic income or universal health care or jobs for all, that sort of thing. And I would say we can afford all those things. And then the reason is because there's not enough money in the economy. We need to put more money into the real productive economy because of the way our money is created as a debt, and there's always more debt than there is money available to repay it because the banks don't create the interest when they create the debt. That's one reason. And then much of the money that is created as principal in these debts doesn't go back into the productive economy where it's available for borrowers to use to pay off their loans. So you either have to do a debt jubilee periodically, as Michael Hudson has shown, in order to, you know, fill that gap, or you can fill the gap with actual money, like pouring money into the gap, helicopter money, and it won't be inflationary. It just stabilizes the economy so you don't have to go through booms and busts. So that was the basic gist of my session.
It's a huge horizon and quite interesting. And it's funny how nature is the most efficient way of cleaning up the situation. But also you're pointing out that what allows the damage to persist is the economic systems, the capital-based systems that invest in tractors and fossil fuels and agribusiness and so forth, that is really all over the world, devastating agriculture all over the world. Evo Morales, the recently deposed president of Bolivia, in his statement to the United Nations, was cited that whole agriculture, agribusiness damage that has been done, and capitalism itself damaging people's lives and democracies that are basically overwhelmed by oligarch profiteering methods. So I mentioned that because when you're talking about a green transition, the United Nations recently said that moving toward a green future will depend on publicly owned banks. Why not privately owned banks? Why can't private capital take on this kind of a massive project?
Well, it's their business model. They're required to make as much money as they can for their shareholders. In fact, I just, somebody was telling me that you read one of these prospectuses why you should invest in this company, and it was because our goal is to maximize profits for you, the shareholders. So by definition, they are not looking at the best interests of the community, and there are many things like infrastructure that we need that is not going to pay back, and it's not necessarily a big ticket profitable investment. But a public bank will invest in those things. We can invest in those things. I mean, all you have to do is break even if you're a public bank. Just the fact that you're making low, below market loans to businesses that desperately need that credit and that will do great things for the economy. They will, you know, they will add jobs. They'll add products that we need and so forth. Makes it worthwhile. Plus, a public bank can take the long view, so they could think about what this is going to mean for the country 30 years from now, or for the state, or versus watching the numbers go up tomorrow. Right. Which is what investors do. You know, they're very focused on getting their money out in a short period of time. They want it to go up all the time. Want the numbers to go up.
So the money is the primary focus, not the welfare of the planet, of the people, none of those things.
Well, and that money is being sucked out. It's being sucked out of the real economy, and it's going into another economy. It's like you've got two economies, and the speculative investor economy sort of feeds on itself. The stock market keeps going up, even though everybody says, how can this be? Those businesses aren't really doing that well, and yet people keep buying their products. But it's because it's a big casino, and more money is getting poured into it, and that just drives the price up. But the money doesn't come back out. It goes into offshore tax havens, or big investors, billionaires, don't need to buy consumer goods, and so they're not in that consumer market.
So you've illustrated exactly what is driving so much of the public banking movement around the country, and this week has been huge, as I started out saying, in so many ways. Those issues of what the people need and really are insisting on getting can be delivered with public banks, and the news out of the East Coast and the West Coast this past week is that there's new action in California, where, as we've discussed previously, the state has codified the creation of municipal public banks and given 10 cities the opportunity to create banks within a 7-year period. Well, now the race is on. San Francisco this week has introduced legislation to set a timetable for a San Francisco public bank, hoping, I think, to get ahead of the line of Long Beach, Los Angeles, Oakland, and others who've already expressed an interest. But the San Francisco supervisor, Feuer, has set a task force time between now and June of next year that will revise and really, in some ways, repudiate the year-long task force that the city treasurer's office did last year, which said that it would take 30 to 50 years to become profitable and entirely too much money. That notion repudiated and said, look, if we plug in different factors, the bank could be a lot more profitable a lot more quickly. And so that between now and June, they're going to be examining how that can happen. And then in the following 6 months, they're going to create a business plan for a San Francisco public bank, municipal bank. So that's pretty exciting. But clearly, the biggest news is out of New Jersey. And I'll just share a personal comment here. The governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, when he was a candidate, we had talked to him about creating a public bank and basically consulted with him at that time, and they put together a plan about it, and we met in a social event, and I said, you know, California is coming on with their public bank. I think they seem to be leading the pack. And he looked at me, he said, New Jersey's going to be first. And I thought, well, this is that's great, you know, from your mouth to God's ears. And then after the California action in September, I thought, okay, California really is going to be ahead. But lo and behold, this past week, Governor Phil Murphy created an executive order that establishes a 14-member implementation board whose function it will be is to determine how a bank can get created in New Jersey and to come up with a business plan within a year. Now, really, setting the framework for a business plan, we understand that the business plan is probably going to take a little bit longer than 1 year. But why? Why the urgency for this? Murphy has been a very progressive actor and has done a lot of work already in New Jersey to clean up a bunch of issues. But I thought it would be interesting to see how he characterizes the need for a public bank in New Jersey. And I'm just going to read a couple of items from his executive order, which illustrate exactly what you're talking about, and that is that these needs are not being met. So this order says, whereas New Jersey residents could meaningfully benefit from expanded access to below market rate capital for creditworthy and socially beneficial projects, including support for public infrastructure, affordable housing, neighborhood revitalization, small business lending, and higher education financing, and whereas a lack of access for small business loans, affordable higher education loans, affordable housing, all of that contributing to startling wealth gaps in New Jersey, and whereas a state-owned public bank could leverage public and private dollars to finance and support sustainable and forward-thinking projects that would benefit the public interest, how a public bank could address the declining market share and unique goals of community and minority-owned banks and strengthen nonprofit entities like credit unions, community development corporations, and community financial institutions, what we call CDFIs, and whereas the state could should consider working to reduce economic leakage by responsibly retaining capital within New Jersey, like North Dakota does, right, to build its core economic sinews, as you will. The state currently has dozens of lending authorities and commissions, but they could be coordinated better. Public bank could assist in that, and this implementation board will be looking at that. And whereas public banking remains a powerful model for public accountability and democratic control of the government's financial resources, for all those reasons and others, he created this board for planning and development of the public bank. And the objectives will include assessing the capital needs of New Jersey's small businesses, students, local infrastructure, and housing, and conduct public meetings and support and enhance coordination of services of the state agencies, identify how a public bank can strengthen the capacity of our local banking institutions, and develop a business plan for a public bank that will allow this thing to move forward, as well as importantly, to consult with experts who know something about public banking. So he's taken a huge step forward here for New Jersey, but also for the nation, because what he has done is gone beyond just a law that says it's okay, you can do it, but he's really put the state on a path of saying how it shall be done and when it shall be done and who will do it. So it's a very exciting breakout there for New Jersey, and we're very excited about what can happen here, being from New Jersey myself.
Yeah, that's great. And we were at his press conference, so that was exciting. I've always said that where there's the political will, they can do it, and vice versa. So if you've got a treasurer or whatever, as in San Francisco in that previous task force, where they really don't want to do it, they will find reasons not to do it. But if they really want to do it, they will find ways around those barriers and manage to do it. Or, I mean, it's not as easy, I suppose, for a governor as for a president. But look at what Roosevelt did, or the head of the Fed, heads of the Fed. Look what they've done. Like, Roosevelt took the dollar off the gold standard. Everybody said, you can't do that. But he did it. And the Federal Reserve printed $3.7 trillion in quantitative easing. And everybody said, you can't do that. It'll be hyperinflationary. And it wasn't. It worked. Many things. Lincoln printed, doubled the money supply with greenbacks, and everybody said you can't do that. But
yeah, and something dramatic needs to happen because the economy and the equity issues are failing miserably and catastrophically across the country and, frankly, all across the world. I mean, we talked about this before, about people being in the streets out of austerity and deprivation on all hemispheres. The banking cartel is up for renewal, maybe redesign. We had talked about an ultimate goal of nationalizing the Fed, and this has been a theme that you've mentioned several times. But short of that very grand ambition, it would seem, and I'd like you to speak to this, to some sort of what sort of an interim step legislation might take to make the Fed more responsive to some of these opportunities and needs.
Well, they could revise the Federal Reserve Act to read something like Japan's, or even more like China's. But particularly Japan says that the Ministry of Finance, which would be like our Treasury, will work with central bank in forming policies. So the government will say, we want to build this or that, and we're going to fund it with bonds, and we want you to buy the bonds. And don't sell them back to the market. Buy the bonds, hold on to them, keep rolling them over, and rebate the interest to the Treasury, which is basically what the Fed has done with its quantitative easing. But the bonds they bought were mortgage-backed securities originally, and then government securities. So they've tried to sell the bond. Their intent was to sell the bonds back. That there was always they were going to normalize things eventually after the heat was off. But every time they've tried to sell them back, it's rocked the boat and the stock market has dropped and all the investors freak out and then they reverse course. So they've discovered they really can't sell them back into the market. But still, because it's considered a debt and it's the presumption is that it will be collected someday. It goes into the federal debt, and then everybody says, well, we can't go further into debt because we've already got this giant debt. But what the central bank could do is just hold on to them and or rip them up, better yet. Anyway, you could revise the Federal Reserve Act to sort of force the Fed to work with Congress. And then there's the model of the Federal Home Loan Banks, where basically all the banks belong to this thing called the Federal Home Loan Banks, and they all pool their extra money in there and borrow from the Federal Home Loan Banks. And because it's such a big, supposedly it's a government-sponsored enterprise, so everybody thinks it's either part of the government or it's protected by the government, then they trust it, and it gets to go first. You know, it gets different privileges, then it's able to borrow very cheaply. And basically what banks can do is take their loans and put them up as collateral and borrow from the Federal Home Loan Banks. So we could do the same if we had like a network of public banks. They could all sort of share, put their extra deposits into a big pool and use that to leverage each other's funds.
So these ideas all reflect maybe the need for a mandate, perhaps a congressional mandate, that the Federal Reserve will only be involved in certain types of provisioning of capital that would play away from the financialization channels and more directly into a productive economy.
It's sort of like a wartime.
Yeah.
The wartime model where the central bank is supposed to work with the government to fund the war because everybody thinks that we can change the rules when we're at war because our lives are at stake or whatever, our country is at stake, and just let Congress or some government body determine what kind of loans can be made, make sure they're productive loans or they go into the productive economy.
It's a good analogy. I think, you know, we've touched on a lot of things here, but the analogy of a wartime footing for our financial system is maybe what we need to be working toward. As we've said, we want banking to become a utility, not just a speculative commodity-based industry and casino. And that sort of a mandate is perhaps where we need to head in order to get past some of the freewheeling, profit-taking, avarice-based business modeling that is putting us in such dire straits, not just here, but all over the world.
As governor of New Jersey, actually having the will to set up a public bank, when I was researching for presentation in Korea, there was a Korean economist who pointed out that Korea was sort of strong-armed into accepting the World Trade Organization and the Bank for Internet, you know, all these international rules for capital and so forth. But so Ha Jun Cheng, the economist, pointed out that big banks that did international finance were required to comply with those international rules. But if you were a local bank, local regulators could change the rules for local things. So your governor could work with your local state regulators and ease up on some of the regulations for a public bank, because you already know it's going to be in serving the public interest, and you'd be hiring public servants, and you don't have to collateralize your own money. You shouldn't really even need FDIC insurance for your own money, but I guess we need that in order to engage in with the other banks across state lines.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's some rules that could be bent within the state by the state regulator.
And that's where we find ourselves now in the process of creating public banking in America. We're learning what opportunities there are. We're discovering what obstacles and barriers there are. We're also devising and thinking of what kind of alternatives, workarounds, and improvements we can make at this time, given that we know that the current banking system is not going to sustain us going much further. Well, Ellen, thanks very much. We'll get on with our interview with Dr. Sean Vanatta, and we'll see what happens next week.
All right. Great talking to you, as always.
Given the encouraging news out of New Jersey and California, we thought it would be fun to reprise a brief musical interlude with Swami Beyondananda, reflecting on the difference that having a public bank can make. Feel free to sing along.
California's a failure because we haven't got a bank.
Well, what would you do with a bank if you had one?
Do? If California had a bank?
We could rightly use what's ours to cultivate the flowers and clean our septic tank. We could trade unemployment for service and enjoyment if we only had a bank. When we're stuck and need some credit, and Wall Street says, forget it, we won't be in the tank. We could pass on lesser offers, borrow cash from our own coffers, if we only had a bank. Oh, why? Tell me why. The economy hit the floor. We're sinking lower than we sunk before. And all the jobs, they've gone offshore. We can stimulate production, construction, and instruction by standing for this plank. Just 11 million voters will be like North Dakota, we'll finally have a bank. If we get up off our assets and get the folks to pass it, we'll finally have a bank. A bank.
Swami Beyondananda also answers to the name Steve Behrman. Our thanks to them both. Now we take a closer look at the nature and practice of money with Dr. Sean Vanatta of the Gallatin School at NYU, who is a historian of modern political economy. Dr. Vanatta's book, Plastic Capitalism, Credit Cards, and the Political Economy of Modern America, argues that from the 1950s, profit-seeking bankers exploited American federalism to avoid consumer regulations, and by instituting credit cards, connected far-flung consumers with volatile global capital markets, leading us to the indebted nation that we know today. In an interview we did together on our Public Bank Solution TV show, I asked him a very primary question. What really is money?
So we all think we know what money is, right? You pull out your wallet, you have sort of green paper in it, and that is money. But of course, money takes a variety of forms in our modern economy. Bank deposits are money. Bitcoin, maybe, is money. Your credit cards, well, you buy things with them. People give you stuff when you hand over a piece of plastic. Maybe that's money. Once you start to think about what is money, how does it work, it really kind of breaks down a little bit. And so, you know, this is something that's also true across the American financial experience. So if you think about the 1800s, if you could charter a bank, then you could print your own money. There were rules about, you know, converting that money back into gold and silver coin. Well, maybe the gold and silver coins were money and not the banknotes. But there was this freedom to create, as Hyman Minsky said. It all comes down to who will accept the money that you print. Out of that same idea comes community currencies. So in places like Baltimore, communities can get together and say, listen, this script, this piece of paper that I'm giving you, it's the equivalent of a dollar. And as long as we all kind of agree that that's the value the piece of paper has, then it's money. Mm-hmm. You know, economists will tell you that money is a medium exchange, a unit of account, and a store of value. But often those functions can be are served by very different media throughout the economy at the same time. It's more common that monies are redundant and multiple than being sort of singular. As we tend to think about money as a singular thing, as the dollar.
So people have a disconnect because of that historical trend that money is something physical, a unit of value, which of course value is determined in the marketplace, so that's a variable in and of itself. It seems that in the three things that you mentioned, the medium of exchange seems to be the consistent aspect or characteristic of money that conveys its real power. So in that sense, it's a relational device, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd say money is deeply relational. We have this idea that money is a thing that's separate from credit and debt, for instance. But when we think about something like a bank deposit as money,
right.
A bank deposit is a debt. When your money is on deposit at a bank, the bank owes you that money. Mm-hmm. And so you've contracted a debt with the bank. When a bank makes a loan, it creates a deposit, creating both a loan and a debt at the same time. It owes you the money that you have on deposit with the bank. You owe the bank the money that you've borrowed from it. And so this is really consistent throughout the history of money, going back since money has existed as a concept, that the kind of debt and credit relationship at the core of money has been, I think, more common than the way that we think about money as distinct from those things now. I mean, that's why the sort of joking when I said, is a credit card money? But I think we often don't think about the fact that when you sit down at a restaurant and put a credit card on the table, that you're not using money, that you're contracting a debt, that the bank is going to pay the store or the restaurant, and that you're going to have to pay the bank. And so this simple transaction that we think of as involving money, as just making a payment, actually contracts a series of involves a series of financial transactions and obligations that all are tied into this one simple movement of sliding it across the table. And so it's that relational aspect and the kind of relationship, again, between money and medium of exchange, something that seems impersonal, and the very interpersonal relationships of between debt and credit that undergird money, I think, that are really important.
The unit of account, most of our money is just digits. Only 3% of our supply of money is real stuff. But bank credit is certainly money because of its acceptability. And that the notion that fiat money, what it's called fiat money, you know, the fabrication or the extrapolation of a capital base, has been regularly criticized as being not real, that is just somehow pie in the sky. But that's really right to the heart of the question. It's not real stuff, it's just credit. And our economy is built on debts, on a debt-based economy, so that when money is issued, it's often issued as a debt. But is it real? Does it have to be that way? Can money not be a utility that's issued as a credit? Coming from the idea, for example, that money is not scarce, there's no real limit to money except inside of an environment of accounting. I think in the public banking movement, we talk about the need to move toward a utility, a public utility available to all. Any thoughts about that shift in characterization?
Well, I think the one way to think about it is that banking, to some extent, right, is always a utility, but who has access to the utility? And the idea that money has to be tied to the real world is also a kind of consistent idea, but how is that access determined? And so when you think about the old commercial loan theory of banking, so this is the way that people thought about an organized banking in the 1800s and early 1900s. The idea was that you would only lend money on goods sort of involved in trade or in transit. So if you owned a store and you were gonna buy merchandise to stock your store, then I can make a loan as a banker. I can make a loan on that because it's tied to these real goods, right? It's called the real bills doctrine. Mm-hmm. But it's not legitimate for me as a banker to make a loan to you as an industrialist to just have working capital to work, you know, to continuously cycle through your enterprise. That's not a legitimate form of commercial banking. And so it's this idea that like some kinds of transactions are worthy of access to financial institutions because of the way that we conceive of, the way we imagine banks should work and others aren't, is what creates the kind of limits to access that, you know, it seems like public banking is really keen to break down. That we decide there are certain kinds of transactions that are appropriate and certain kinds that aren't. And those decisions are often couched as economic decisions. Well, you know, this makes economic sense and this doesn't, but they're actually often cloaking political decisions. Mm-hmm. And in an economy where the emphasis is on commercial trade and not on industry, it's those who are involved in commercial trade who have political power. And so they want to structure a banking system that serves their needs. Mm-hmm. And so it takes a long time for industrialists to gain control of the financial system to then restructure it to serve their needs. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, neither of those people are people on the ground, disadvantaged, you know, workers. And so it takes even longer then for workers to create small-scale financial institutions where they can interact, where they can get deposit safety or get small loans. And so there's a kind of constant process of reshuffling and restructuring the financial system to serve groups that are outside of it. And so the idea then that there are kind of fixed and constant rules and principles is a way of trying to keep things the same.
The same, yeah.
And you know, to maintain the advantages that those who already exist within the system have, while keeping out those who want change or who want a different kind of access.
Yeah. Interesting. So at the outset of our program, our little introductory piece says, money moves the world and banking moves money. Let's talk about banks and banking for a little bit, because the industry has changed a lot over the years, of course, as we would expect. But in the U.S., quite a bit of change has happened. Talk a little bit about what those changes look like and what the impacts, some of the impacts have been in, the last 40 years in particular.
Sure. I think an ethic that was central to the way that people thought about finance in the United States, really from the founding until very recently, was this idea that really sort of revolved around community banking, that our community should have a bank, that our best citizens should run it and should fund it, and that it should lend locally. Mm-hmm. And so you see, you know, again, if you look back 40 years, there were states that were unit banking states, where a bank could only have one branch office. Mm-hmm. There are states that really limited branch banking, so that you could, sure, you can have branches, but they can only be within the city that you're founded in. National banks could not build branches outside of the state that they were chartered in. Mm. So it's a very localized financial system, and it's that way by design. In the 1920s, there were 30,000 banks in the United States. Now, again, they weren't always stable. There's a real problem when you lack geographic diversity, when you're only, you know, you're in a farm community that only grows strawberries and the strawberry market collapses. The bank is going to collapse too.
Yeah.
And so that kind of multiplies certain kinds of instabilities. But it's rooted in a political ideology that's very localized. And so it's only really in the 1970s. There's challenges to that throughout the US history, but that ethic is really powerful. And it's only in the 1970s that that starts to break down, where we get the rise of interstate banking, where we get the rise of national credit card plans, where you actually can take your bank credit from, you know, New Jersey and go to California. It's those kinds of movements towards centralization and consolidation that begin in the 60s and 70s, and of course we're, you know, continuing to live through them today as banks continue to consolidate. We get a larger and larger banking oligopoly in this country. There are advantages to that. I mean, certainly it's convenient to take your credit card and to go across the country and use it. It's convenient to know that there's an ATM that you can use anywhere you go. But it also has real negative side effects for communities where they no longer have those, you know, citizens in the community who own the bank, who are invested in the community's success, who are committed to recirculating their capital within the community.
What they used to call good old boring banking, just investing locally and making local loans. And now that's going away and if not mostly gone. What is it now? It's turned into something like called financialization. What's the banks are really into financialization as opposed to lending locally. Why is that and what is that?
Well, financialization is a term that scholars have started using in the last decade or so that incorporates a lot of different things. I mean, one, I think, key aspect of financialization is securitization. So the idea that we're going to make loans and then bundle them into securities and sell them in financial markets. Of course, we know all about securitization because of mortgage-backed securities, which again, there are advantages and disadvantages to this kind of system. So financialization is about giving people access, more access to finance. It's about creating more access to credit, but often in ways that are unstable. So, you know, financialization enables real estate bubbles in Florida that then blow up and, you know, help cause the housing crisis. It's the idea that as a lender, I can lend you money and then sell it to someone else and not be all that concerned about whether you pay it off. When banking is small and local, I then actually do really care if you pay it back because it's my money that you're going to pay back. I'm not selling that obligation off to someone else. And so it's a kind of combination of technology, which then enables that kind of sort of risk evaluation and resale. And again, this concentration that pushes trends like that and have pushed trends like that recently. And another way to think about financialization is that for certain groups of American citizens, finance is pervasive in your daily life in ways that it wasn't. You know, you think about being a worker in the 1960s, well, maybe you have a defined benefit pension. So you don't have to think very much about your retirement because you know that those decisions are being made for you. Now, you have to manage your 401k. I mean, do you know the very best investments to secure your retirement? I certainly don't. And I study, you know, so there's a lot more risk for individual consumers, and individual consumers are expected to shoulder more financial decision-making than they had been. Some argue that's a good thing, that we should have the power to make those decisions. But I think that then requires people to take on and process huge amounts of financial information that we don't necessarily, as everyday people, you know, have the knowledge to do, right? And so I think that's another way to think about financialization is pushing finance to the center of our economic decisions on a daily basis, which again create challenges for people that don't necessarily have the education or experience with finance to make the right decisions in those areas of their lives.
Yeah. Another part, of course, is that financialization becomes the primary objective of banking holding companies as to how much profit can we make on the money, quote-unquote monies, that we've got in circulation. So that everything is the denominator is how much money can we make, as opposed to that level of investment in the real economy. And doesn't that then lead toward inflation? You know, an inflation of the monetary reality, because it's just getting pumped up, and up beyond a sense of relational reality.
Well, I think, I mean, inflation is complicated, of course. I think that there are certain aspects where bubbles form, right? And so we might think about that as somewhat different than inflation, but related in that asset values, you know, again, home prices in Florida seem to be going up and up and up forever because there's finance that's supporting it.
Right.
And then once that support is removed, then those values collapse, right? And so again, it comes down to something, you know, maybe we started talking about at the beginning, what is money is fundamentally tied to a question of what is value, right? So if we think about a store of value, that's a function that money has, thinking about money that way requires us to step back and think about, well, what is value and what do we value? And how do our social values interact with our economic values? And so if our social values are sort of community and interpersonal interaction and local development, those suggest a different kind of financial structure than one where if our value is profit anywhere in the world under any circumstances, then that suggests a different kind of values and value, which then pushes capital in certain directions, which can then, under certain circumstances, lead to asset bubbles, which then crash. And I think you sort of see, especially since the consolidation of finance in the 1970s, a continuous series of asset bubbles. So you have the dot-com bubble before you have the housing bubble. It's capital in search of the most profitable thing can herd into specific kinds of investments, inflating their value until it becomes clear to everyone at the table that the value that they've ascribed to the thing is not really what it's worth.
So we have hundreds of trillions, nominally hundreds of trillions of dollars of derivatives, a meaningless sort of a figure, and no reality around that, and yet markets are hinged and pinned to those numbers. What about that that unreality? I mean, they're working in a world of fantasy finance that seems to have nothing to do with real matters of concern. What part of the business is that?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's often interesting to think about these as sort of social problems, because for some businesses, those derivatives are very real, right? You make certain kinds of, you know, if you're a farmer, you want to be able to know what the price of wheat is going to be in the future, and maybe you want to be able to make a hedge on that price.
Right.
And so the derivative actually really matters to you. But that sort of real economic activity that's made concrete through the derivative is also, how do you tell the difference between that and a trader making a bet on the future price of wheat, right?
Right.
And it's
right.
those distinctions which have been, again, an ongoing and long-term challenge for governments and for societies to really think about, well, there are certain kinds of economic activities that we think are useful and are important. We want the farmer to be able to hedge on the price of wheat because that's going to make sure the farmer plants the wheat in the first place. If they can't predict the price, they might not see the value in planting, and then society doesn't have the wheat, right? How do we then protect against that turning into a kind of gambling, to kind of be reductive about it? And that's hard. And again, it's as much about the values in a society where we say, what we all agree on is that we shouldn't do this, and we will sort of socially, as well as, you know, through regulation, bar certain kinds of practices. But unless society sort of reflects on those questions and really thinks about, again, what is money, what is value, what do we value, then we end up in a world where it just makes sense to continue to push the envelope. What's the next innovation or deregulation or financial practice that we can come up with that is going to offer just a little bit more profit, or profit in just a little bit of a different way than we had before?
Yeah, interesting. I think that kind of illustrates the difference between money as a commodity of pursuit and control and power, and money as a utility representing a public utility, representing certain commitments, social commitments, that we want to preserve and encourage. And so we see we're at a time now in, we mentioned some of the new variations of what money, the form that money has taken, and also the sponsors of money. You know, corporations taking on this whole new role of creating capital or creating a type of currency. What do you see about money as we look forward?
Well, I think it's a really interesting, because like the Facebook Libra or something like Bitcoin, it makes us a little bit, some people anyway, a bit uneasy because, well, it's not a dollar. It doesn't have the backing of the U.S. government. And so you feel a little bit nervous about that. Why should I take my dollars and turn them into Bitcoin or Libra? It doesn't seem to have the same security as a U.S. dollar. But the fact of the matter is that commercial banks are also private corporations, and they're creating the money just as much as Facebook does.
Sure.
There are different kinds of protections behind it. You know, the FDIC is there to secure your deposits. But at the end of the day, it is still investors in that corporation that are determining the policies that it pursues and the ways that it takes the sort of power and resources that control over that money gives it and mobilizes those. And so I think that, like, thinking about Libra as problematic because it's created by a corporation, I think that's not necessarily the way to think about that problem. I mean, why does Citibank get the privilege of being a bank and creating money, and Facebook doesn't have that privilege?
Right.
It seems as though if we make a decision as a society to entrust money creation with private corporations, then I think the arguments for opening up that franchise are as strong as the arguments for limiting it. But, you know, again, that I think that's very different than the argument that we should shift that franchise into public institutions, or we should more strongly regulate the private institutions that have control over money. There are reasons, I think, to pursue that path as well.
Yeah. Of course, having the full faith and credit of the country behind you makes our money so valuable, and now we see it's diminishing around the world. relative to other currencies and so forth, based on a lot of things, of course. But because money is made when banks make loans, it's a concept that I think is relatively recently understood, but thankfully increasingly understood, that this is where money comes from, that banks have this central role, then seeing banks as public utilities becomes kind of a new horizon, a new canvas on which we can paint some possibilities, especially when you're talking about a sovereign bank like the United States government. So we talk about UBIT for a moment as we have to conclude here. The universal basic income rests on the idea that there's enough money to do this. And of course, that goes against the idea that there's money scarce. So what about that dichotomy? Talk a little bit about why we could even do that and why it's not true that not enough around.
Well, so I don't know as much about modern monetary theory as I should, though this is, I think, the underlying concept to UBIT and some of these other ideas. I think the idea is that money exists because of the federal taxing power, right? So the federal government can create as much money as it wants mm-hmm. if it also creates taxes to reabsorb that mm-hmm. money. Mm-hmm. Sure, we can create a universal basic income and provide money to every citizen of the United States, a certain amount, to ensure that they have the freedom to pursue whatever creative or other things that they want to pursue, and they've got the kind of basic income to do that, so long as we also create an equal tax to then pull that money back out of the system. Mm. Because money has its value fundamentally in the fact that it pays taxes. That's what differentiates national money from some of these other forms that we've discussed. And so the federal government then pushing money into the system but making sure that it can also pull the money out of the system is what means that there won't be the inflation that I think people really worry about.
Right.
Right.
And I think also the need for increasing amounts of money and, of course, the stimulus that comes from giving people, personing the economy, enables that artery of commerce and health to continue. Any comments about this moment in monetary history? Are we on some sort of an edge or are we on a fulcrum?
It's hard to say. I think just to come back to our earlier conversation, what excites me about the public banking movement is that I think there's an opportunity to really rethink what banking is. It's something that societies are always kind of working on, but that I'm optimistic that there might be some political will to introduce new kinds of financial institutions, to experiment, and to see, you know, what kind of future we can build together.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Dr. Sean Vanatta teaches at the Gallatin School at NYU. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.